This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, I'm worried about those gremlins across the countryside who are wreaking havoc by blaming everything on healthcare reform. I'm a little worried about those insurance companies over the next few years who might unrealistically increase our insurance premiums. And certainly, those increases will surely be laid at the doorstep of reform. Apparently, I'm not the only one with this concern.
I think the country should be worried about this. There's always something to worry about with health reform, but the possibility of major rate increases is a big one. Meanwhile, one of the things we're going to try and do is not just help keep our listeners' pulse on both public opinion and what's happening with the unveiling of health reform, but also to pay attention to what's missing. Senate Democrats seem to have recognized that one thing that's missing is federal oversight of insurance rate increases. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California has now introduced a bill that would allow the Health and Human Services an opportunity to make sure that rate adjustments are justified and fair.
She lit into WellPoint, a health insurance company who used a special computer program to target breast cancer patients and terminate their health coverage. She was so angry, and she said it on the floor of the Senate. We have a duty to protect the American people from the corporate greed of these for-profit, publicly traded health insurance companies. Left to their own devices, companies like WellPoint will throw paying customers to the shark for the sake of profit. And that's why she introduced the Insurance Rate Authority Act of 2010.
Well, it was stories like that, of which we heard a lot in the past several years, that I think ultimately swayed the country in the direction of the health reform we now have. But Mark, I want to touch on Medicaid for a moment. The experts are estimating that of the 30 million people who will be newly insured, about 20 million, two-thirds of them, will be insured by Medicaid. That's a huge expansion of Medicaid, and it's a fulfillment of its original role to ensure that low-income Americans have access to health care. But wow, is it going to test the capacity of Medicaid and the healthcare safety net for poor and lower income families? Likely to be challenges all the way down the line, from infrastructure at the state Medicaid offices to overcoming the tendency of private providers to not sign up for Medicaid at all.
Margaret, we talked about Massachusetts' stress when they introduced their reform bill. They just didn't have enough primary care providers in place. That's why the framers of this health care reform bill committed themselves to expanding the community health center network with an $11 billion investment over the next 4 years to help ensure that there'll be delivery points all across the country. They also provided $1.5 billion in funding for the National Health Service Corps, which pays for the education of healthcare providers as long as they do some service in medically underserved areas or at a community health center. They were thinking about the problems.
Mark, I think it's about time for us to do a show both on our community health center and on the system of care known as community health centers across the country, one of America's best-kept secrets in healthcare. But for now, I'm going to turn our attention to today's guest, Dr. Ed O'Neill, who's got a handle on creating the future of healthcare. Dr. O'Neill is director of the Center for the Health Professions, a research, advocacy, and training institute dedicated to educating a healthcare workforce that can lead the improvements in health and well-being of people and their communities. Dr. O'Neill is a professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine and the School of Nursing at the University of California, San Francisco, and we're delighted he's here to speak with us today.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you would like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. O'Neill, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. After Reuters reported that the insurance giant WellPoint had been intentionally dropping coverage for patients recently diagnosed with breast cancer, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius made a point to highlight the wrongdoing in a lengthy reply to WellPoint executives that was also made public. Insurance companies have used the practice known as rescission for years, but under the new law that goes into effect later this year, insurance companies will be banned from dropping coverage for people who become sick. Reuters said WellPoint used a computer algorithm that automatically targeted patients recently diagnosed with breast cancer. WellPoint CEO Angela Braly responded to Secretary Sebelius in a letter saying that the Reuters report was inaccurate and misrepresented the insurance company's efforts to help patients detect and treat cancer. In any case, the situation signaled the administration's aggressive approach toward insurers who unlawfully deny health care to Americans. This news is also a chance to talk about how women will benefit under health care reform. In 2009, the National Women's Law Center, an advocacy group that worked hard to get the new law passed, found that insurance companies charged women up to 84% more for individual and small group policies than men, even without coverage for maternity care. In other cases of unfair practice, some women simply can't find an insurer to cover them. And for women who have insurance, sometimes it just doesn't cover certain scenarios like pregnancy. Secretary Sebelius says women being charged more for being pregnant will change in the new marketplace.
She won't be able to charge women two and three times what you can charge their male counterparts because they might get pregnant.
Provisions in the new law will help women in several other ways. Mid-sized employers will be required to provide a place and time for nursing mothers to lactate. New insurance plans that start up 5 months from now and later will have to allow women to go directly to an OBGYN without a referral from a primary care doctor, and insurers won't be allowed to charge co-payments and other upfront costs for preventative services like mammograms and pap smears. This week, we're discussing the healthcare workforce and its importance in moving the country toward meaningful healthcare reform. Our guest today, Dr. Ed O'Neill, is the director of the Center for the Health Professions at the University of California, San Francisco, an organization that has done a tremendous job to ensure that the current workforce, as well as the next generation, can lead the way forward. One way the center achieves this goal is through numerous leadership programs for nurses. Certainly, a lot of attention has been focused on initiatives to address the nursing shortage. Since 2005, Governor Schwarzenegger has been funding the California Nurse Education Initiative to provide funding for nurse training that can directly help the critical shortage of registered nurses. The nurse leadership programs at the Center for the Health Professions aim to do more and draw on the larger role that nurses play and can play in our healthcare system. Mary Dickow is the deputy director for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Executive Nurse Fellows Program at the center, an advanced leadership program for nurses with the overarching goal to lead and to shape the healthcare system for the future. She says nurses have an important role in healthcare reform.
Nurses are primarily the ones delivering the care, or In the case of our program, the ones really shaping those that will deliver the care. So in the case of nursing education, they have a direct impact on how the curriculum is shaped or what the student's experience is. And in the hospital systems, they would have, of course, an impact on what the role of that nurse on the front line is. And in public health, they're out delivering the care to a great extent in the community.
All of the nurses in the program work on a project that actually influences the way care is delivered. And just to highlight how such a program can influence healthcare reform, our very own Margaret Flinter, a Robert Wood Johnson Executive Nurse Fellow herself, refined her idea for a family nurse practitioner residency program during her work as a fellow. The first such residency program of its kind in America started here at the Community Health Center, and it's now a model for a national training demonstration program in the healthcare legislation that was just passed in March. Let's listen now to the interview with Ed O'Neill to learn more about meaningful health reform for our future.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Ed O'Neill, Director of the Center for Health Professions and Professor in the Departments of Family and Community Medicine and the School of Nursing at the University of California in San Francisco. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you.
You're both a historian and a futurist, a great combination of perspectives as we move forward to the implementation phase of the national health reform. You stress the importance of finding a midpoint between government and the marketplace, recognizing that healthcare can't be left to the sole province of either. And you've talked about the genius of the American middle, where the pragmatists come together to create good policy that leaves enough room for individual action and responsibility. How does that middle way translate to the future of healthcare in the context of this national legislation?
We have to reinvent the practice models in a way that builds in that kind of public support when necessary, but individual accountability and engagement and involvement throughout. And that's going to require us to think differently about how we understand the professional role, what we finance, how we regulate, how we educate, beginning in the earliest years, so that there is this sort of expectation of responsibility on the part of the consumer. And we're also going to have to think about policies that shift some of that responsibility back to the patient, consumer, public as well. But the kind of responsibility that looks at behavior, that looks at contribution, that looks at material effect, and then prices your share of healthcare accordingly. So continued substance use, tobacco, alcohol, and someone refuses to seek any kind of assistance to change that behavior. All of those things are things that we're going to have to reconsider in how we think about individual responsibility. But we also then, backing that up, have to be prepared to have a public system, whether it's delivered privately or publicly, is kind of unimportant, but we have to have a publicly supported system that will help those individuals be more accountable.
Ed, the kind of healthcare system transformation that you're talking about obviously requires leadership, and maybe at a level we just haven't seen before in healthcare. Now, you've done a lot of work both with emerging and seasoned leaders in California and also nationally, and you've identified these three core domains, and you can tell that we do read your work, that you see as the task of all leaders in our new reality: coherence, efficacy, and community. Can you elaborate on those domains, and how do we train the next generation of leaders in them?
The healthcare in the U.S. is the sixth largest economic undertaking on the face of the globe, and it's complicated. But it's complicated in part because that's how we've made it. So to change that means that we have to be able to say with some very clear first principles, this is what we're trying to achieve. This is what success will look like. And it's got to be coherent to the provider. It's got to be coherent to the public. But we need broader public discussion around that to get that kind of coherence. One of the concepts that I've been trying to push for a decade is this idea of a health commons. What I mean is that tradition in America of communities coming together to do things in common, whether it's raising a barn or it's building and supporting a public school system. But we need that same kind of ethos for healthcare, in which I've taken the responsibility as a citizen, as a consumer, as a patient, to actually learn what I need to do to take care of myself. Efficacy means that it's got to work. It's really got to be able to demonstrate that we're using the resources wisely, that we're selecting the treatments that have the greatest probability of a positive return. And it's also being candid about what we can and cannot do. And then on the community, we do need broader definition of how we participate in healthcare. We actually know that kind of engagement actually produces health in and of itself. That's not why I'm advocating for it, but it's that community engagement and involvement that I think is just essential. It's a system that is understood and valued by the entire community.
Speaking of promoting health and things that have to work, the primary care setting is really where the focus is in the reform legislation. And there are many incentives in the bill that reward primary care providers, those in practice and those who are applying to the field. Do you feel these incentives are aligned with our goals for prevention?
I do think that. I don't think they're the last word in it, but it's the beginning of a redirection of our healthcare system. A Dutch MD physiologist, a guy named Bernard de Vries, wrote an article many, many years ago called Unraveling the Mystery of Health. What de Vries said was, you know, why don't we look up from the tissue and the organ to the system, to the human, to the human interrelations and the broader community, and look for health there, not just in correcting the chemistry. So primary care gives us the beginning to move care back to prevention and management. And management's probably just as important in primary care as prevention. In fact, in some ways, prevention really is the domain and responsibility of the individual assisted by the professional. But once we have the onset of disease, managing that disease, keeping that person out of the hospital, out of the treatment modalities, is really an important part of what we need to do for the future.
So, Ed, let's stay on the healthcare costs for a minute. And certainly there's been lots of criticism that the reform bill won't lower costs quickly, and they're probably justified. But the point wasn't made strongly enough, I think, that one person's cost is another person's income. So
right.
We see options like curtail access or cut the prices, neither of them very popular. So let me just ask you a bit of the futurist perspective. Do you think there really are significant cost savings that we can achieve by covering the uninsured, managing those chronic diseases, and investing in prevention, as you just said? Or if you were making a prediction, will we still see runaway costs, at least for another decade?
So the only option really is to re-engineer or redo or refocus, reimagine the way we organize and deliver a unit of care. I think there's some money to be saved long-term in prevention, but that's a very long-term. That's a couple of decades before I think we begin to see big material returns. I think that the bigger and more readily available, accessible option for us to save money is to look at this large burden of chronic care, so diabetes, arthritis, congestive heart disease. Today, what we do predominantly is we tell somebody they have this chronic disease, and then we manage that care in the old acute care settings, a visit to the physician for 15 minutes every 6 months or so, a hospitalization when things get out of control. So the option, Margaret, is to actually say, now how do we use these resources? And there are a lot of resources once we, you know, look at how much all that acute care treatment costs. How do we use those resources to manage that care in a different kind of way? Maybe we need new kinds of professionals, promotoras and community health workers or medical assistants working in extended fashion. We need to think about changing behavior once the diagnosis is in. We need to think about wraparound supports. And while some people look at those and say, wow, that sounds very costly, the few studies that have been done in these different areas would indicate that, yeah, it's a different kind of expenditure, but it's a lower expenditure. The galling thing is we have 20 years of research from the Agency for Healthcare Quality Research that would point to all of these well-established, evidence-based ways to manage that care differently. And we need to incentivize people's movement to those.
Today we're speaking with Ed O'Neill, Director of the Center for Health Professions and Professor in the Departments of Family and Community Medicine in the School of Nursing at the University of California at San Francisco. I want to sort of pick up on that theme about managing things a little differently. There's no doubt that the big question out there over healthcare reform concerns healthcare workforce. Covering more people means that we need to find a cure for our healthcare workforce shortage. And I'm sure this was on your mind well before the healthcare reform legislation passed. It was certainly the experience out of the Massachusetts reform effort. Can you break down for our listeners how critical this issue of healthcare workforce shortage is? And what initiatives have you been promoting to provide access to better training and education in healthcare?
It's important for us to think about what are the resources that we have currently. Not just do we staff with our personnel to the old model of care, but how do we think about the resources that we have, institutions and professions? What do we want to achieve for the future? That's why this Health Commons idea is so important. And then how do we staff to that? What do we have an abundance of? What do we have too few of? And how can we make up that difference in some creative and different kind of ways, not just building new capacity, not just taking what we've done in the past and projecting a straight line into the future?
So, Ed, one more factor I would lay into that is the demographics of the workforce we've gotten. Let's just say the average age of physicians and nurses is up there, right? Somewhere in the high 40s. But equally important, it seems to me, we have a generation of young adults and kids who are not likely to want to get their health care the same way that their parents did. Instead, we see a push for they want it electronically, virtually, using lots of different media than coming into the office. So maybe we have a gap in expectation that we need to bridge. Who's doing that successfully. Have you seen any examples out there of this?
So the places that are, that I think two places that are doing a nice job of that, on one end of the spectrum is Kaiser Permanente. They've been they're the largest organized system in the country, and they don't operate across the country. But in those places where they do operate, they've instituted a medical record, and they've not only used that medical record to administer health resources more efficiently and then to provide clinical information to the professionals more efficiently and effectively. Most importantly, they've rather aggressively used that information tool to change the way the consumer thinks about and interacts with their own health information, and their practitioners. It's almost like banking 25 years ago, when banks made us all our own tellers, and now we do a whole array of financial services using those online resources. And then in the other place, the other end of the continuum, I would say, is in community clinics, where we're actually seeing, in part because they don't always have every resource available to them, beginning to think about how that practice model can change using paraprofessionals, using community members, having individuals help each other in self-help groups and group visits to the clinic, and thinking about health within the community context.
Let me pull on the thread of innovation. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see that excites you in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners of Conversation be keeping an eye on?
The state Medicaid program in Colorado has been this tremendous font of innovation. In terms of hospital care, Virginia Mason up in Seattle has been particularly outstanding. I think Virginia Mason has very aggressively pursued the route of changing itself with unflinching courage. That is to say, change what we do, even if in the short run it negatively impacts our bottom line. And hospitals are going to have to confront that and live with that reality, but much better to lead it, I think, than to have it pushed mm-hmm. back on you. And then in terms of medical group, out our way, the Palo Alto Medical Foundation has demonstrated to me a kind of consistent, at least strong set of innovations.
Today we've been speaking with Ed O'Neill, Director of the Center for Health Professions and Professor in the Departments of Family and Community Medicine in the School of Nursing at the University of California, San Francisco. Thank you for joining us today, Ed. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In past weeks, we've brought you stories about walking school buses and trayless cafeterias. Today, the bright idea focuses on a broader initiative to make schools healthier places for our children to learn and develop. After spending years working to make their three daughters' schools in Illinois healthier and safer, Chevy Chase and his wife, Janie, founded the Green Community School Initiative with the goal of using their personal experience to improve schools around the country. Although their chosen name more readily aligns them with traditional environmentalists, the main impetus behind the initiative is children's mental and physical wellness. The Green Initiative focuses on several environmental factors, both inside and outside the classroom, that frequently compromise or endanger students' health, such as transportation to and from school, indoor air pollution, reduction in recess and PE time, as well as limited food choices in the cafeteria. Green initiatives are powered by students, researching, designing, and implementing plans with teachers' assistance. For example, this year, students at Al Raby High School in Chicago have taken on the task of making their school healthier and safer. They organized a community trash pickup day for school's playground and surrounding streets. They have begun to research their school's air quality with the help of science teachers. Green Community School Initiative programs have begun to make a real difference in students' health. Children whose schools are part of the Green Initiatives are less likely to be overweight or to experience pollution-related respiratory illnesses. The Green Initiative has also succeeded in improving the social atmosphere in schools. Instead of sitting in class all day without interacting with each other, the students are taking charge of their school environment and working together to implement projects of their own design. This increased sense of community and purpose has led to decreased levels of violence and aggression by students. The Green Initiative has worked to make these changes long-lasting by partnering with the Maryland G. Robb Foundation, which works to reduce socioeconomic and educational barriers for low-income students. The foundation conducts violent prevention workshops in participating schools. All of these changes mean that students are better able to focus in class and retain what they learn. The Green Community School Initiative is now active in several Chicago and Detroit schools, and programs elsewhere in the United States are on their way to becoming a reality. With its comprehensive approach to student wellness and its use of student input, the Green Community School Initiative is helping communities take control of their children's health by making their schools safer places to learn and grow. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health